Senator Mallory, M-A-L-L-O-R-Y, Horn, H-O-R-N-E, President of the Florida Senate, May 21st, 1974, Tallahassee, Florida.
I'm involved in a statewide race as soon as this damn session's over. Okay.
Sounds like it's going to be quite a race.
It is. Well, there are four of the seven or eight in it. Really have a pretty deep background and tradition in Florida's government over the last few years. All of them pretty tough, top-notch people, so that makes for an interesting campaign.
Well, you're one of the senior members of the legislature.
Yeah, I don't like to call it that anymore. That means you're old.
Not in this legislature. That the senior members are also young. You travel to other states and see the president or the speaker and so on. They're all 50, 60, sometimes over.
Yeah, I've been at this stuff for 20 years now. Neither one of you have a match, I imagine.
I might.
My lighter's gone.
I have one and sometimes I don't.
You're one of the few legislators who bridged both eras. That is the pork chop era, so-called, and an era since 1967. Could you tell us a little bit about both and the differences between the two?
Well, there are great differences. There are a lot of difference. First of all, in the organization and structure of the legislature, there are monumental differences also in the philosophy of those who, and technique, really, of the other. While I was in the House during the heyday of the so-called pork chop group, which was a group in the Senate. They were predominantly businessmen, very conservative, and they ran an exceedingly tight ship. Their rules were extremely loose, rules of procedure, and their technique was very autocratic. I remember the first bill I introduced, and I guess that's like a mother having her first child. You're very, very proud and very paternalistic. And it was a bribery bill and tightened the bribery laws in the state. I passed it through the House and then it vanished. Of course, we had none of this technology that equipped us to really follow a bill. So journals and calendars were the only source to go to find the progress of your bill. And though their rules call for notice, I never received it to the introducer. I never received any notice, and after an embarrassingly quiet week or 10 days, I became alarmed and concerned. And during that period of time, I was really ashamed to admit that I didn't know what might be happening. So I went to our speaker, Ted David, who's dead now, and confessed that I didn't know what was happening. And he smiled, suggesting I go see my senator. I did, and he sent me to another senator who was chairman of the committee of reference. And when I went to him, well, he said, "Why, son, your bill's dead." And I, in shock, reminded him that I was supposed to have notice and cited him to his room. He said, "Oh, we called your office and gave you notice and left you notice, but your bill's dead. We've had a hearing and it's been killed." And he literally pulled out his drawer and showed me my bill. From that day, which really wasn't typical, but by proxy voting, they frequently would have a committee meeting with only the chairman there or a vice chairman there, and he'd have proxies from all of the other committees so that each senator would have a number of significant sounding committees on his letterhead. Every member was chairman of a committee, literally, and which meant that the logistics of the session kept them from being able to attend all of the committee meetings. So proxy voting was vogue. Proxy voting also occurred in the House, but it never reached that point. They didn't have quite that many committees. Every member was not a chairman. The legislature then and now is best characterized by really just painting a picture for you, really, of the legislature when I arrived. We didn't even have copies of the bills that we were supposed to vote on. This really was an affront to me and to a lot of the younger fellows that came there. There were 6 copies available, and only the senior deacons had access to those. They go to committee hearing, and the chairman would have a copy, and he would read from parts of it. And for the most part, the crunch of legislation, we were then handling almost twice as many bills in half the time as the next busiest legislature. We met biennially and for 60 days, and much of that was ceremony. So we had to rely on capsules of information describing that bill by people who had a pro or a con interest in it. And it was frightening at best. The House then, while they had a sound system, had no office facilities, and the only time a member had to use a secretary from the pool was on the floor or in committee. So it was rather common practice for members to be dictating on the floor of the House while debate ensued. The consequence of that was that there was no atmosphere of deliberation and no orderly procedure there at all. It was almost a shouting contest. And most frequently, the member who had the floor, unless it was a bill that had intense interest behind it, he was literally talking to a group peripheral to him. And we had actually then 2 legislatures. Under court construction, our legislature began and ended, the constitutional one. The curtain rose at the beginning of the 60-day biennial session, and that's when the power of that legislature began, and it ended when it ended, when it adjourned. It had no power to recall itself, had no power for any interim activity at all. Because of some constitutional language that the court construed to be a constraint on any extra session jurisdiction, there developed a technique around that called the Legislative Council. And it was composed of 1 member from the House and from the Senate from each congressional district. And they became the interim work product, such as it was. They could introduce bills in the legislature. And
they were ad hoc.
Yes. And exceedingly powerful. They really, and as you might suspect, and the chairman of that, it was rotated between the House and the Senate. They're naturally developed because of they had access to the staff and to the work product and to the study and all of that. They had the best legislative information that was available. The session had none, except those people who had an interest would volunteer talent, you know. Literally, in the critical areas of appropriations, we borrowed from the executive branch some of their budgeting people to help us put together the appropriations bill. So, except in an area where you had the time to really pour into one little small item of the budget, we were absolutely really at the mercy of what the executive wanted to spend. The tacticians were powerful people, and jealousies developed between the council that operated for 1.5 years and the ceremonial legislature. To be sure that there was a separation of this vast power, the speaker and the president would never appoint to the committees the same people who'd been on committees over here, because that was a submission to the other, and vice versa. So there never was an interfacing at all. In fact, an inbred conflict. And
who appointed the members from the various congressional districts?
The speaker and the president.
I see.
But once they got on it, they just stayed there because they became powerful enough to help name the next. At some point way back, probably, you know, they.
So the continuity in the leadership remained on the legislative council, but not in the formal legislature.
Right. And so we were really a rather ill-equipped, inept legislature during those days. The ceremony was there and the honor was there, but as far as being a test of the executive branch in any way, we were not. Only on the most volatile issue of the times did the legislature speak any real philosophy. It really enunciated the executive requests and demands. Really an impatience of younger fellows with coming out of World War II and out of college after World War II began to demand the series of changes that we really are still involved in producing, because change, when it involves a power structure, of course, is excruciatingly painful. So now, from that description of the problems of the legislature 20 years ago to the problems of the legislature today, during that period of time, of course, we've abolished the legislative council, and I was fortunate enough to be the drafter and introducer of Senate Bill 35 that put the coup de grace to that monster. And I did it after reapportionment, put so many freshmen in the legislature that didn't know what that really was. We were able to jam that thing through literally in a matter of 3 days before those who were on it could really regroup and realize what power they were relinquishing.
Had it been set up by statute before that?
Yes.
This is the Legislative Council?
Yes. Now, that's not the I may be thinking of their own name now. It was such a horrible. And the other was the Reference Bureau, Legislative Reference Bureau. Then we changed and had our Legislative Council become the body of research and library and all of the other services for both.
What was it before? Basically a bill drafting?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, the other problems is that the other end of the cycle has been that we've moved in that span of years to a totally computerized legislature with almost complete services through it, instant capability of identification of a measure and its present status, with offices, good staff, which we've been able to keep highly professional for the most part, as professional as politicians can tolerate, as massive power changes have occurred, of course, the personalities have changed some, but they've been replaced by very professional people and talented people. And we've gone to annual sessions and we revised our constitution and we restructured the executive branch and we restructured the judicial branch. And where we are today is in one terrible situation. We've become so expert, so staffed, and so computerized that we have taken on more of a load than the human equation can stand. The House, for example, has started a continuing review of bills introduced. They don't ever get through with that process, which means that we receive from them at the first part of every session 700 or 800 bills that may have been the work product of the House over 2 years. In other words, if a bill passes to through one committee 1 year on a dual reference and goes to the second session, then hits the floor and is dies on the calendar because it wasn't reached, then that's where it is at the next session. And this is a very compounding situation. It probably is best, but it's only best in the context of more time. What I'm really trying to describe for you is that we have all of the facility for capsuled information from our own people objective then in source and intent. But the in the ultimate impact is that a member has just so many hours, and we reduce that capsule of information to its most infinite context. And he's getting this literally running down the hall, eating lunch in a hurry, spending 16 hours a day, over half of the session. The ones that really work. And really, for quite another reason, we've lost the time to really dialogue with each other, to really deliberate, to spend enough time really exhaustively pursuing the complex ramifications of a particular measure. So I see this session really indicating now a necessity to take the next step, and that's remove the time constraints on a session. We still have a compulsive 60-day session. Even though it's annual, it isn't helping, because it's just a continuance of the last one. So that's a thumbnail, really. I guess your question probably would develop more.
What you've described is almost as though you're talking about the legislature suffering from some sort of legislative future shock. You've had so much change so fast coming on that it's hard to... The human equation.
That's right.
But do you propose then an open-ended session, or just a longer, limited time session?
I don't want to go to open-ending, because then it might slow down too much.
You're saying 60 days isn't enough, but there needs to be a limit somewhere?
You're right. I would like to... I think we're going to have to... One, we've got to face this question of whether a bill, and this needs to be a joint deliberation during this interim, faced with the House proposition of whether a bill ever dies by virtue of the adjournment of a session. If that one is crossed in the negative, so that a measure just continues to be before the legislature, then we have to evaluate. We have studied, for example, in the Senate, it reached such a crucial point on the human thing. By the time my predecessor in title took the chair, that I recommended that we evaluate the pressures on us. And I took on the responsibility for doing it. So as I reviewed the build-up before a session and examined by time spent on bills, I found really a remarkable curve, with the pressure being noticeably more apparent in committee time at the outset of a session. Up to this time, by the way, we were having sessions every day simply because they'd had sessions every day historically. The Senate convened and the House did too every morning, and we had a half a day session every day. During that period of time, we were largely debating relatively non-controversial bills, but because we had to be there for 3 hours, senators debated longer and they frolicked around a little bit. So when I evaluated this curve of the corresponding and changing pressures, it was apparent that to get immediate relief, we needed to give the committees more time in the beginning and take more time away from the floor. So first 3 weeks of our session, we don't have but 2 floor sessions a day. That keeps pressure on that floor, so that they're moving and not wasting.
2 a day or 2 a week?
2 a week. Did I say 2 a day? Excuse me. 2 a week. And we load up on committee time. And then as they begin to expurgate that load, and the bills in committee begin to diminish, and this is about the third week, then we begin to fold, and the calendar begins to grow. We begin then to fold in another half a day a week, another day a week. And till then, we're diminishing our committee time, and then we're meeting every day and twice on 2 days. So it's just a standpipe, approximately corresponding to the changing workload. And that helped a lot until the House changed its rule. Well, it still helped. It would be insufferable without it now. Now we're in double sessions every day, and committees, the ones that have to, are meeting at night. And what's today? Tuesday. Tonight is the last time our committees can meet without a waiver of the rules. On the theory that any bill that still has to be debated in committee with a 38-page calendar with 1 week to go is, unless it's an emergency. And then we have monitoring for the major bills, and if one of them is still tucked in there, and one still is, we'll go in with a waiver of the rules and have a hearing on that bill and bring it out and try to give it urgent attention. But a human being isn't a computer, and as much as the age and education has changed over that 20-year period of time, there still is an emotional and clearly discernible limit on what a person can handle during a day. And we are, whereas we at one time reached that during the last week, we begin to reach it now after 2 weeks of a session. Only strong evidence of the conclusion that we can't compact what Florida has to do in 60 days anymore. I don't know how long it'll take them to admit that, because it's unpopular to admit it. Frankly, the combination of the times and legislators and politicians too being at the bottom end of the rung, most people would just say, well, hell, let's don't have a legislature or don't meet. And they laughingly say, you know, we're better off if the legislature doesn't meet. They may be, but if they are going to meet, the whole idea is to deliberate, and the atmosphere is not good for that. Then you take the other thing too, 15 or 20% do 90% of the work, and then you're really killing those guys. They walk around in glassy-eyed in the last 3 weeks of a session and get really get sick. So that's a problem really that's consequent of the progress, I think. We've, here in the Senate, we're undertaking a unique thing that may work. Did Louis Delaporte talk any about our ombudsman program?
No.
Let me take a minute just to mention it, because it's unique in the states. As a businessman, I have viewed our biggest failure over the years to be, first of all, I view the legislature. Its primary role to be a check on the executive branch, a test of the executive branch. And where that really comes into prime focus is in the appropriating process. Now, to a businessman, the appropriation process is two vital and separate functions. First of all, and the same needs to apply in government. First of all, he needs to evaluate the functions to be performed by his business or to be performed by government, and then to allocate of the existing dollars in priority those dollars to those functions. Now, the legislature has been doing that in increasing independence and increasing capability. In the beginning, in my beginning, 20 years ago, that was a farce. We had, as I said, our tools were their tools. We had no way in the world of knowing what functions of government were being performed. There was no index or digest of them. And even worse than that, we didn't know how to evaluate the priorities. So we had to take their priorities. So that part of the appropriation cycle improved dramatically over this period of time with the independence and with the capability of having budget people working concurrently with the executive branch, evaluating how many dollars we'd have and where they ought to go. That part we have begun during the last 6 years to do fairly well, and fairly independently, very independently as a matter of fact, and to develop in that process new programs for the executive and to fund them. But the second part of that process is vital in a business, and the chief exec does this, and the board does it. The legislature needs to be about the business of doing it, but finding a technique to do it without itself becoming a terribly expensive and onerous thing, was a challenge. So what we did, beginning with my term, was to try to find a scheme of testing. Here's what that function should be. You probably know it as well as I, but the businessman then follows constantly. He may do it on a selective basis because he can't really know all of them. We have different techniques in my business. I constantly would, without much notice, call in and really get down deep into the performance area. But it's efficiency testing, performance evaluation. But he follows his dollars to see how well they're doing the job that he intended when he allocated the dollars. Now, that's the role that the legislature has been absolutely unable to perform in any state, and certainly here. So I realized that the one thing we had all the time, constantly, from the level where government touches people nose on nose, was complaints. 20-25 telephone calls a day during the interim came to me, and I assumed to every senator and every House member, from people who were involved with government. They were bitching at me because they couldn't get an answer, or they were getting sidetracked to another agency, or they were getting wrong information, or a multitude of things, running the whole gamut. Well, in the past, and each member, to serve his constituent, had to, first of all, find out where in the hell that job was being done. And I'd call, I'd get two or three answers, and I'd finally find the guy that could give me an answer, or that interviewed that person. Hey, what's the trouble? Well, we'll try to get to him. Yeah, all right. And I'd call my constituent back. Okay, you're right. The State Road Department, when they put in that culvert, did use the wrong elevation. They are flooding your yard, and they're going to come fix it. They'll be there next week. So I multiplied in my mind the experiences like that I had every day. And so I called in the senators. And we developed, with a lot of ideas from different sources within the Senate, to sophisticate things. So here's what we did. And it's beginning to work. The executive surely doesn't like it, so that means it's got a chance of working. First of all, we got some smart people in government. We evaluated Florida's government. This took 8 months. We broke out all of the functions of government expressed in verb form, very minute, infinite verb form, to do a small thing so it could be instantly controllable. And we computerized that index of functions of government expressed thusly, to do blank. And we put that in the computer. When that same job was done on a regional basis first, then we computerized that fact with the geography constituting that region. And we also then added the top cat's name that was responsible solely in that region for the performance of that job. And we trained people to answer the phone. Then we talked to senators and, look, rather than you bothering with all your complaints, when they call, you either give them this number and tell them to call the Senate Ombudsman, or you get the information and give it to the Ombudsman. And in every case, when we solve your constituent's problem or give them the answer, we'll do it in your name to keep the political end of it in balance. If we isolated him from his constituent, they wouldn't cooperate. So we started folding in. The first few months, we did this in-house to test our equipment and test ourselves. And then we put on an ongoing toll watch line so that different regions can call directly. We began to advertise down there, sort of a place to complain to, you know. But the important thing wasn't constituent service. The idea is that we take those complaints, and when they begin to patternize, and they do, by the way, about 15 or 20% of them are misconceptions of entitlement or misconceptions of what government can do, you know. But 80% fall into some real interesting classifications. And what we're doing there is sending those complaints, the summaries of those complaints, to the Committee of Jurisdiction, to the Ways and Means Committee for next year when they meet with those people, and we also sent it to the agency because the prime purpose is to help them. And so we're into the business now of following the appropriation into a performance evaluation. And that...
Can you give us a couple of examples of how that's worked? I mean, the ombudsman, just from your own personal experience?
Yes. Woman in my district calls me, and now I'm just telling them to call that number. In fact, if when incoming falls, my own procedure, because I'm present, really, and too busy. But most senators, let me give you a classic example. In Ocala, a person going for aid to the blind, complaining that they'd taken a month and a half or 2 months, and still filling out forms or couldn't get a decisive answer of whether they were entitled or not, or getting a no when they felt like they were entitled, call in to me or direct to our ombudsman. Okay, they, first of all, attack that computer. It comes up with a statute number, and they check to see whether under these circumstances this person evaluates, does this woman's age and this degree of blindness certified by the doctor, does that constitute blindness? Are they entitled? Then they pick up the phone, the watch line, they call that top cat in Ocala, who's regional head. Mrs. Johnson has been in and out of your office for 3 weeks, she says, trying to perfect her claim for aid to the blind. What's the trouble? Well, the Tallahassee office has to. Well, no, your own rules say that you make the final decision unless there's a controversy. Okay, so tell her to come back. All right, then we call that lady back, go back there, but we catalog that gap and that complaint. And we send it to governmental operations, we send it to appropriations to evaluate. Then they sit down with those people when their appropriation comes up and talk to them about it. One, and we found two or three things indicated. First of all, we found in some cases,